Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is sociologist and author Elaine Leader. Leader is a professor of sociology and dean of the School of Social Sciences at Sonoma State University in California. Previously, she was a professor at Ithaca College. She has published 5 books and more than 2 dozen articles on sociological and psychological issues. Her most recent book is about her experiences teaching in prisons. It's called My Life with Lifers, Lessons for a Teacher, Humanity Has No Bars. It was published last spring by eBooks Unbound. And I'm speaking to Elaine Leader by phone from her home in Northern California. Elaine Leader, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here with you. Thanks for inviting me.
Now you confess in the beginning of your book that you have always been drawn to the darkness. Did you think that's why you were attracted to looking into prisons and prisoners?
Oh, absolutely. I say in the book that my father was a Holocaust refugee and lost his entire family. And so, you know, the shades were drawn in my house, and it was a dark and sad place. And so, you know, darkness is part of my life. And then, you know, I had some difficulties in my upbringing. And as I started to get out into the workforce, I found myself very interested in first victims of crimes and victims of domestic violence. But then, more interestingly, I was drawn to the people who committed such crimes or perpetrated violence. Why would they do it? I wanted to know, sort of based on my family's background. Mm-hmm. And so that's what drew me to prisons, although it was rather fortuitous that I was drawn there. A student said he wanted to go to a prison, and I was at Ithaca College at the time running a high school class who had come up to look at universities. And so we went down to Elmira Correctional Facility, and after the tour was over, I asked the warden if there was any education inside, and he said, well, we have GED. And I said, well, are you interested in any other kind of education? He said, of course. So that was the beginning of my career.
Well, what made you ask that question and decide that you wanted to do that?
Sometimes one wonders why one does certain things. It was an impetuous moment. And again, because I'm really interested in perpetrators, and by that time I'd been working with perpetrators of domestic violence, plus I really do believe in the power of education. I wouldn't be where I was today if it weren't for my education. So I believe everyone deserves an education, and it'll transform their lives. And so I just offered, but I figured it wasn't going to be much. I just, you know, go down and I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but I sort of put together this little program where we went down every week, ran a class. Ithaca College ultimately gave credit for the class. I volunteered to teach it. I was teaching Intro to Soc, so it became Intro to Soc. I got books donated by publishers, and I started to invite faculty members in who would give guest lectures. People came from Cornell, from Ithaca College, and the guys really, you know, got the message that something interesting was happening up there besides AA and NA and religious organizations coming in. So it grew. It grew very quickly from about, I think, 5 or 6 guys the first week to about 35 on a regular basis.
That's great. And I understand that you did that for 6 years from 1995, right?
Yes, and then when I got to California, I had a semester off where I wasn't doing anything in prisons, but then I found out about a program at San Quentin called the Prison University Project. It's also run by Patton University, and they grant associate's degrees, again, with volunteer faculty members. So there was my niche, and I, again, taught Introduction to Sociology, and it was a remarkable experience, and when it was over, a couple of the guys and I had become, you know, they'd become my students, and we had a good relationship, and they invited me to become a co-sponsor of an ongoing prisoner-initiated group called New Leaf on Life. That's what they called it, and I became the co-facilitator of that, which I've been doing now since 2004 or 2005, I guess.
Mm-hmm. To tell people about San Quentin, it's in the San Francisco Bay Area. To tell people about it.
It's an incredibly beautiful location. It's out on this little spit of land right near Larkspur Landing where the ferries come in. From it, if you were not a prisoner, if you were just looking, you can see Oakland and the Bay and the Bay Bridge and the Golden Gate Bridge and the San Rafael Bridge, and it's surrounded by water and fog, and then the fog breaks and the sun comes out. But it's a fortress. It was built by prisoners who lived on a barge, incarcerated on this barge, and they would be taken off every day, brought to this site, and they built their own prison, and then they went inside and lived there.
That's amazing.
And it was in the mid-1800s that it was built, and it hasn't changed much since. I mean,
well, it's notoriously overcrowded. Is it still? I know that that's been its legacy.
Well, yes, but, you know, now we have this realignment plan in California where the courts mandated that 33,000 prisoners had to be moved because of the overcrowding. And so it's less crowded than it was, say, 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still got everything you would imagine about a prison, 6-7 tiers high, with guards with big chains and keys, and men walking in lockstep if they're new, if they've just come to prison. You know, they're still being processed. Their experience is fairly stark. There are three groups of people at San Quentin. There is death row, and although I've been up there, I don't work on death row, and they're very much segregated from the rest of the population. Then there are the new folks who are just being processed. They come in with buses from their county jails, and then they're processed for their educational level, their mental health, their physical health, and then they're sorted and sent to all the prisons around the state. But there's also a group, and this is the group I work with. They're called the Mainline. And these are guys who've already been sentenced, and they know that they're going to do their time, and they do their time in various prisons. San Quentin, actually, for the Mainline population, is a pretty good place to be. Because it's in the Bay Area, there are 3,000 volunteers who come in every few days, weeks, and we all run these groups and projects. And so prisoners in California want to come to San Quentin because it's the best of them all, even though physically it's very daunting as an institution.
Oh, yeah. You know what I want to ask you, too? I was surprised when I read your book that is it still racially divided? I didn't realize that that was the case.
Well, it's illegal to be racially divided, of course, and so it's been mandated not to be. But it happens that way because whether it's determined by the prisoners or by the institution itself, it is a fact that groups stick with their own kind. So you walk down the roadway onto the yard, which I do often, and you'll find in one corner the Norteños, and they're mostly, we don't have Southern California people sentenced in Northern California, at least not many.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the Northern California Latinos, the Norteños, and then there's the white folk, and there's the African American group, and then there's the Asian Pacific Islander, and then there's the other. There's always an other, and that's people who just can't be classified in those major groups. And actually, housing is done in the same way. Cellies tend to be of the same racial mix. But you'll also find that once they get into programming, there's a lot of mixing that goes on. And so people become buddies and close if they're in any kind of programming. But once you go back into the yard or into the dining hall, you're supposed to sit with your own kind.
Wow. So that's part of the education then, isn't it? People coming together who normally wouldn't have.
One would like to think so, but, you know, there are a lot of fights inside, and so people try to just make sure that they don't happen, and so it's easier for people not to mix. So it's done through programming, but not really through living experience.
I want to ask you this, Elaine, too. How did you build a trust with these prisoners? Obviously, it must have taken some time. Did you think about it beforehand and come up with some techniques? Or?
No. I'm rather intuitive. I used to be a psychotherapist in a previous incarnation of my life, and I'm a sociologist by training. I just walked in the first day, and needless to say, the first day I was scared out of my mind, as everyone is.
I'll bet.
You know, what's going to happen to me? Am I going to be mugged? I remember it was probably about the first couple of weeks. This was at Elmira. There was some sort of an altercation in the yard, and it was downstairs from our classroom. And I was scared, and the guard came in, because the guards are not in the classrooms with us, but the guard came in and said, you all must stay here until this quiets down. So I was freaked, and the guy said to me, Elaine, don't worry about it. We'll protect you. We don't want anything to happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the fact. They don't want anything to happen to us because we're coming in from the outside. We're bringing normality for a moment. They have the experience of the life of the mind, of talking about ideas while they're studying and thinking with us. It's as if they're in any classroom in the world. So they're not being separated as different or felons or the meanest of the mean. We're treating them as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And if you treat them as human beings, they treat you back as human beings. And they're incredibly respectful. I have better treatment by my prisoners than I do by my own students.
You mentioned that in the book, yeah.
Yes. And it's wonderful. I mean, they're always coming up and thanking me, and they're always saying, you know, they'll engage with an idea as we walk away from the classroom. I don't have my students come up to me and tell me that class was fabulous or, you know, can I talk about this idea with you more? That doesn't happen in undergraduate education, not very often.
Yeah.
So I love it. And so the trust built, of course, over time so that now, you know, I consider some of these guys my friends. Others I don't, and there are others I would not, you know, want to know outside, but there are some who have paroled, so I do know them outside, and they're human beings who have redeemed themselves.
Yeah.
They know what they've done. They've made amends with society. They've apologized to all that they can. They've done their time, and they're good people who made a bad mistake.
Yeah. Well, you know, you talk about how you teach sociology, which often opens the eyes of the prisoners about their own experiences. Can you talk to us a bit about that? And a lot of them probably haven't thought about classism and racism and how their lives were affected in that way.
That's part of the joy of watching it. I had a couple of incidents that I'd love to tell you about. One, a young man who is now out and working on his bachelor's degree in sociology at San Francisco State, learned about critical consciousness and racism and false consciousness and just about segregation. And he wrote probably the most profound piece I've ever read on racism in prison and the self-segregation and the segregation being imposed by the authorities to keep people separated so that they wouldn't join together and form bonds which then could threaten the powers that be.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really smart argument, really good argument. And then another incident that I just still think about often. My original field in sociology is domestic violence, family violence.
Mm-hmm.
So I was teaching about this concept. Jacobson out of Seattle came up with this idea about cobras and pit bulls, men who are batterers, who the pit bulls are the ones who latch on to somebody and are jealous and selfish and have low self-esteem and hold on to their victims and batter out of fear of loss of them. And the cobras are the ones who are slick and cold and don't have a lot of emotion and can beat someone and walk away and, you know, go to a bar and have a good time. No remorse and no sense of responsibility for what they've done. I was talking about this concept, and that's a very gross simplification of Jacobson's argument, but for the sake of this, I'll summarize it. And I went into the class with these ideas, and the guys resonated, and they said, oh, yes, of course, but Elaine, you need to know, you all start out as pit bulls, but then we become cobras. There is nothing. And I thought, I'm sure Jacobson didn't think about this, that it was an evolutionary process of becoming batterers.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Elaine Leader. We're talking about her book, My Life with Lifers, Lessons for a Teacher, Humanity Has No Bars. Now, I want to talk to you about the fact that you mentioned in your book that 95% of all prisoners will eventually be released,
mm-hmm.
but prisons seem to have backstepped from rehabilitation. Talk to us about that.
Well, and that's the piece that I find the most disturbing. You know, we all have this image of lockup, where these people are cold, hard criminals who, you know, are just beating and raping each other and and just, you know, have tattoos all over them and are just animals. And the reality is far from that. Yes, of course, there are those who, you know, I wouldn't want to see out on the streets. But the fact is 95% of all prisoners are released eventually, either if they've done life, because life means you, if you have life with the eligibility of parole, it isn't life unto death. And then there are the short-timers, the guys who were given, you know, short time of maybe months. I don't have many of those who I work with, but years, 5, 10 years. And so they're all going to get out. And prisons, for the most part, do not rehabilitate. People change their lives in spite of prison, not because mm-hmm. of prison. And my experience is the guys, and all prisoners, because I'm now communicating with a lot of women as well. I'm thinking of doing my next book on women in prison. Mm-hmm. Particularly, I'm interested in Jewish women and Jewish men in prison, because there's such a small number of them. But anyway, that's an aside. The point that I'm making is that in terms of rehabilitation, it's mostly volunteers who go in, and it's mostly Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Christian organizations, Jewish organizations that go in and, you know, they do chaplaincies, and they do marvelous work. I'm not at all negating what they do, but they don't reach everybody, and there's not enough programming in prisons, and we've gone into this period of retaliation rather than rehabilitation and reconciliation. There are lots of wonderful programs that I read about and I've seen at San Quentin that are really about restorative justice, about people who have committed crime making amends with their victims, making amends with the community, interacting with victims' groups, and having deep dialogue about the impact on both the victims and the perpetrators' families, because they're part of the victim as well here.
Of course,
and
yeah.
So when we talk about rehabilitation, we have to be thinking of beyond the retaliation and an eye for an eye model that we have in this country and begin to think, and there are, I have to say, there are pockets all over the country of people who are doing restorative justice and
Absolutely.
Reconciliation
yeah.
work.
Yeah.
And that's what we need to be doing. In a progressive society, that's what people would be doing. If you look at other countries in the world, Sweden, Scandinavia, Israel, they have programs like this where you just don't throw people in prison, lock them up, throw away the key, then open the door. I just have to tell you this story. This blew me away, and this is a personal story that I know of. In fact, I know the guy. There was a man who had been in prison for 29 years. He had been a Vietnam vet, and he was mentally ill as a result of it. And he killed someone when he got out, after working for a while after he got out of the Army. And he did 29 years for the murder. And inside, he really did change his life, and he got mental health care. And, you know, he took up Shakespeare. And anyway, he was discharged after 29 years. He was supposed to go to some kind of a rehab program. But they let him out on a Friday afternoon at 6 o'clock. All the programming was shut down by then. He couldn't get anywhere. They bring him, after 29 years, to the San Quentin gates with a garbage bag filled with his belongings, and they leave him there. Go fend for yourself. Well, you know, those of us who know San Quentin, this is in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it's in San Rafael, but you can't even hitchhike to a bus station.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
right at the, you know, with fog rolling in, it's dark, it's cold. You know, you don't pick up hitchhikers over the San Rafael Bridge right near San Quentin.
That's right.
What's the guy going to do? I mean, he was very resourceful. There was somebody there who also was getting out, and he begged a ride to Oakland, and he went to a homeless shelter.
Wow.
And he stayed there for 3 days, and then he found the rehab he was supposed to go to and found his way to his programming.
Wow.
I mean, that's the kind of thing that we do. We you know, they're in 29 years in prison. He walks out with $200 in his pocket and no transportation because it's after hours.
That's
we do that sort of thing a lot.
Oh,
you know, we just send them out and without plans. And mm-hmm. one has to have a rehab plan in order to be paroled. And no parole board's going to let anybody out without a plan. You know, but we don't do the work inside to get them ready for the outside.
Well, I want to ask you this. So has it been found that, that prisoners who partake in educational programs do stay out of prison in higher percentages?
Absolutely. It's very hard to find data because I looked for it for my book, but there was one study that was done, I think it was 987 prisoners, and they looked to see what was the reincarceration rate for those prisoners who had engaged in any form of education, GED or all the way up through associate's degrees. Mm-hmm. They didn't go into college. They found that I think it was about 90% of them never returned to prison.
Wow.
So education is clearly the answer. Mm-hmm. And I find it in my work inside that when you educate someone, you show them that they have other alternatives and brains that they can use besides anything that they learned out on the streets.
Yeah. And it also helps them get the self-awareness as well, you know, an
right.
awakening about what they've done and
exactly.
how they affected the world.
Exactly. I have a man that I know very well who I befriended inside. He was in my class and then in many of the groups that I ran, and he unfortunately killed two people early in his life as a member of a gang. And he found religion, he got his education, he founded a number of self-help groups in prison. He had to really fight his way out through legal means, and he did win. At this point, he too is working on a bachelor's degree. He works with youth in gang prevention work and mm-hmm. drug intervention work, and he's a model citizen, recently married, working and doing all of this at the same time.
Yeah.
He's a remarkable guy.
What do you say, Elaine, to the critics who don't trust that education's helping these people to transform, but that they're just faking it in order to get out of prison? How uh-huh. do you answer that?
Well, I give them the data. That's why I wrote this book. So I want people to be educated. And I bring people in with me. I have a group of 30 students going with me next weekend where I take them inside. They sit down with a group of prisoners. And for 3 hours, we have an encounter in which these young people can ask any question they want to ask, including, what did you do? What was your crime? What was your early life like? What do you like? And then they see who these people are and realize that they are human, they've failed, but that they're just like you and me, except that they made a grave error that nobody is forgiving them for.
Mm-hmm.
And they're learning to forgive themselves, and we're asking these students to forgive them and to help them get out there and make a difference with other people, because that's what all of these folks want to do when they get out. Now, I'm not talking about the short-timers who, you know, the revolving door, the folks who do crimes, go out, do another crime, go back in, mm-hmm. you know, the revolving door phenomena. I'm talking about people, the group that I'm talking about are lifers, and lifers are people who were incarcerated with a paroled 15 to life, 20
That's
to
right.
life, 25
yeah,
to life,
that, yeah.
and they thought they were going to get out when they did their time. And now the parole boards are not letting them out because of this fear of the criminal. And so they're doing far longer than their time. And that's the group of people that I have seen transformed. You know, you age out of your violence. You don't continue to be a violent person as you get older and you become more aware of your emotions, your body. And all of us have done stupid things in our youth. And many of these folks are tried and convicted as adults, even though they're youth when they commit these crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And they've changed over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the transformation I've seen and I'm trying to tell others about.
Yeah. You know, you talk about the fact that so many men of color are imprisoned in this country, and you argue that prisons are contemporary manifestations of slavery. To talk
right.
to us a little bit more about that.
Sure. Well, when I walked in the first prison, when that was in Elmira, I was struck by the racial disparities, particularly in upstate New York. You know, if you go into a prison, all of the guards are white. That's not true in California, but all of the guards were white in the region that I was working in, maybe downstate's not the same.
Mm-hmm.
And the prisoners were all people of color. So then I began to look at the data, and the data indicated that there were large disparities in the incarceration rate, the arrest rates for people of color, the war on drug situation that really led us to have a mass incarceration of black men particularly.
Yeah.
We have more black men in prison now than are in college. There are more people of color in prison now than lived under slavery. These are all statistical data that has been gathered over time by folks who are really interested in this. There's a wonderful book by Michelle Alexander talking about the new Jim Crow and how incarceration is, you know, the new manifestation of the Jim Crow laws.
And Angela Davis
as well. Works on all of this
well.
Mm-hmm. And so, but for me, what I was really noticing when I went inside were just the disparities in terms of the numbers, the guards and the people who were the criminals.
Yeah.
And the dismay that I felt about that, because I really see the experience inside as looking like slavery. I mean, men walking in chains, the whole imagery that we have from the era of slavery. So
yeah.
I'm looking for my data in my book right now because it doesn't roll off my tongue the way it used to. But
well, there's been a lot of talk about it, especially this war on drugs has placed so many black men in prisons. I mean, it's just unbelievable that we think
Absolutely.
That's a solution.
Well,
what do you think the solution is, though, Elaine? I mean, can you talk to us just for a minute or two about what reforms you would enact if you had the power?
Sure, I would love to. I, when I was a young woman, of course, began to believe in all kinds of dramatic revolutionary transformations. That's not going to happen. You know, I know it. You know, I teach social policy, and we have a concept of that was developed by Charles Lindbloom, disjointed incrementalism and muddling through.
Mm.
And, you know, we're not going to do anything dramatic. We're going to incrementally change things, and we'll muddle through and come through with a few diddling around the edges ideas. First of all, I really do believe that the parole system should be allowed to work rather than being a politicized situation where every administration decides how they're going to approach incarceration. And I really do believe in allowing the parole boards and professionals on the outside to come in and evaluate these folks for lethality. Are these folks really still likely to commit crimes? And there are ways of determining that. You can't guarantee 100% that someone will not. But if you look at their record in prison, and if they have many, many infractions, you know, they still are hot to temper. And if they don't, you'll find out that they're not inclined to reoffend because they've changed inside. I'd also want the parole system to be clearer. It should be more equitable and clear that if you've done X amount of years, you know, you have a determinate sentence, and then you get out rather than just upping the ante. I've had too many experiences working with prisoners where they go to the parole board, they have done everything the board told them to do the last time they went, and now they tell them to do something else.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's arbitrary.
We only have about a minute left. Can you give us some contact information or ways for people to get your book?
Oh, sure. My book's on sale on Amazon.com. You type in My Life with Lifers, or you can do it at my website, mylifewithlifers.com, or you can contact me directly, Elaine Leader, and I'm at Sonoma State University. And, you know, I just urge people to educate themselves about this. There are always ballots and propositions and issues coming up, and most people, when they drive by prisons, don't think about the people inside. Prisoners are people, too, and we just have to remember that, treat them like people, and start to think about their issues, because, you know, I empathize with the victims, but we don't have to keep victimizing everybody because of the victimization.
Yeah. Elaine Leader, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called My Life with Lifers, Lessons for a Teacher, Humanity Has No Bars. Thank you so much, Elaine.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.